This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community amplified.
I want to alert voters in Maryland's 5th Congressional District about the flood of outside special interest super PAC money that is coming into that district in support of one candidate.
I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, Maryland's Senator Chris Van Hollen is not on the ballot this year, but two reporters tell us how he's shaping the elections. After two parents were detained in an ICE raid yesterday, we asked how ICE is changing Baltimore neighborhoods. Then, Pride marches down Charles Street.
Folks also really are aware of this political moment, too, and how important Pride is.
Stay tuned. That's all coming up. And good afternoon, and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. We picked up two more this week. Best Feature and Best Beat Reporting, both by won by John Lee at the Society of Professional Journalists DC Chapter's Dateline Awards. The Best Feature, John's story about Nome Hill. Oh, Nome, he didn't. Favorite of his, favorite of ours, favorite of the judges, too. And I bet a favorite of a lot of our listeners, too. Go back and check it out. On the show today, election season continues as we are into the early voting period, which runs until June 18th. We'll be talking about one Maryland politician who is not on the ballot this month, but is wielding plenty of influence when it comes to those who are. Two reporters have been covering Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen this election season.
So I spoke with Senator Chris Van Hollen this morning. He kept saying his message to voters was to beware.
Tracking his endorsements and opinion pieces, we'll hear what they've learned. Then, a day after ICE detained two people outside of a Baltimore school, marking the first time immigration enforcement has happened on school grounds in the city since President Trump retook office last year, we head to Highlandtown, where Bria Overs, with our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, has been tracking the economic outlook. That's something that changed this spring because it's under the threat of further raids by ICE. And with graduation season wrapping up, we pass the mic to a City College grad who speaks to her former principal, Cindy Harcum, who was looking forward to a long summer after more than a decade and a half in that position. And we wrap up with Pride, which will be a little different in Baltimore this year. The location of the festival this year has changed. The parade, revelers are going to be passing right in front of our studios here on Charles Street in Old Goucher tomorrow. Why? Well, we'll have that for you soon. But first, Chris Van Hollen was last elected in 2022 when he won a second term in office as senator. He represented Maryland's 8th congressional district in the House before that, which included Bethesda, Silver Spring, and parts of Frederick and Carroll counties. He chaired the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee from 2007 to 2011, helping to usher out President George W. Bush while ushering in President Barack Obama. Recently, he's been an outspoken opponent of the Trump administration's foreign policy, including the war in Iran.
Let's face it, Mr. Secretary, the Trump foreign policy has become a dumpster fire.
He visited El Salvador to bring back Maryland resident Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was illegally deported there. And now he's speaking out on political action committees, or what he calls secret money, spent on elections and candidates and speaking up for grassroots campaigning. With no election ahead of him until 2028, he also has some time and money on his hands to find out what he's doing with it. We have two reporters joining us, Jenny Abamu from our friends at WAMU, and Igor Bobich, who covers the Senate for Not Us, that's NOTUS News of the United States. Thanks to both of you for joining in.
Thanks for having me.
Jenny, thanks. We'll start with you. In Maryland, Senator Van Hollen has been doing something a little different this year than politicians who aren't running, like he is not running this year. He's not just focused on endorsing candidates. He's also spending money on them. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, he has an interesting strategy for some of the races that I've been covering in the more southern part of the Maryland area around the DMV. In Montgomery County for the executive race, he began by noting that he was not going to endorse for that race. But he said about a month ago that he was calling out money that was coming into the race. And he called out this PAC that is the Maryland Affordability PAC is known for having a lot of real estate developers and that type of money going into it. And they had put over $1 million into that PAC, and they had already spent around $200,000 or so on ads against one of the people running for county executive, which is Will Jawando. He's more on the progressive side, I would say, in terms of, you know, his policies and how he identifies himself. And so Ben Holland said, okay, I'm not endorsing anyone here, but I want to call out this money that is being used to attack him. That's not how we act in Montgomery County, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, people did think that. I called around to some of the other people who were running just to see what they said about it. And they were like, yeah, I don't get it. What is he doing? You know, and so they did feel some type of way about it, but didn't know how to put their finger on it. And then you had the District 5 race, which is the, I would say, one of the funnest to cover because it's just so insane. And I will say that. I think that's a fair description because there's more than 24 people. There's 24 people on the ballot, 22 active campaigns because two dropped out. And and Adrian Boafo has kind of pulled a little bit ahead of that pack because of his endorsement from Steny Hoyer, who is the congressman who had that seat before. And so, you know, then of course, there's a bunch of other people who, you know, have worked in different parts of Maryland politics in there, but it covers parts of Prince George County and Arundel County and a lot of Southern Maryland. And Van Hollen basically put his finger on the scale in a different way. He didn't endorse again within that race, but he also said called out in a very strong way Adrian Boafo for having a lot of money that came from PACs like Project Progress, which is focused on cryptocurrency, and APAC, which is a pro-Israel lobbyist group. And it wasn't necessarily APAC, but it was an APAC affiliate that was supporting Adrian.
Well, Igor, well, you cover the Senate for Notice. This week, the main primary, Democrat Graham Plantner won. We saw Van Hollen's support for him again after that victory.
What the people of Maine want is somebody who's going to fight for the interests of working people. And Graham Plantner has clearly let people know that's what he will do.
What kind of influence is Van Hollen wielding in D.C. and looking at some of these statewide races in other areas that are very crucial for Democrats? How is his outward support for candidates like Graham Plantner after they've won? How is that different from some of his colleagues?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen Senator Van Hollen be a strong progressive champion in the Senate. A lot of progressives in and out of the Beltway have talked him up as a potential Senate Democratic leader and potentially even a presidential candidate because of his outspokenness on issues like Israel. Recently writing this New York Times op-ed, aggressively challenging Democrats to, you know, step up on Israel, and rather than just calling for a two-state solution, but also conditioning aid to Israel on changing its policies with respect to the Palestinian conflict. But also, you know, him speaking out on all sorts of fronts in the Trump administration, calling out its deportation policies, have made a lot of progressives really see him as kind of somebody to fill the vacuum here in Washington as people continue to question how Democrats are doing against Trump, continue to question Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader. So I think you're seeing him kind of step out on his own here as there is this vacuum and people don't really think the Democrats are doing a good job here in D.C.
And just to go to that, what you said there specifically, Igor, the senator wrote an op-ed in the New York Times outlining how the U.S. should use the same standards for weapons sales to Israel that it does for every other country. And he held press conferences specifically about APAC funding and APAC affiliate funding, as Jenny was reporting. How much difference is this from a lot of other Democrats, at least in the Senate right now? How much does he sit with the people who are there? I guess, you know, what side, I guess, of the party does he really seem to be on right now?
Well, he's definitely on the left side of the party. But I think, you know, whereas in previous years you've seen him in the minority, more and more increasingly he's winning over Democrats to his argument that, you know, it's not enough to just, call for Israel and call for a two-state solution, but the U.S. Senate has to use its role and its power to condition some of this aid to Israel, money that we're sending there, to enact changes there as we see Israel you know, enact this war in Gaza and also in Lebanon now. So I think he's winning over Democrats. Earlier this year, you saw 40 Democrats in the Senate join Senator Van Hollen in voting to block weapons sales to Israel. It's the first time ever that you've seen that many Senate Democrats vote for something like this, which is sort of a barometer, really a barometer of where the party's headed as we go into this election and in the coming years.
And I think I just want to add to this, like, it's not just the Israel situation. You saw when it was Zohra Mamdani, Van Hollen was one of the first, like, kind of more known Democrats to stick his neck out and say, we need to take this guy in and accept him as, you know, the person who won the primary. And I think that that does say a lot, because I was looking at it like, this is not even your state, you know, why are you sticking your neck out over there? But he is seeing him, he is doing this thing where he's kind of putting himself ahead and in front of a lot of different issues, not just in the state of Maryland, but beyond the state of Maryland. And it is worth, and you know, on the ground, what I hear is a lot of people wondering about his political ambitions, right? There's a lot of discussion, a lot of whispers about, you know, what people think he really wants. And it's, and they think it's more than, you know, what they think it's more than just this. They're looking at him and they're saying he's angling for something more.
Jenny, you bring up, and both of you brought up the national role he may be playing in coming years. We'll get to that in a second. But Jenny, go back to you for that 5th congressional district seat in Southern Maryland. Again, that's Steny Hoyer's seat. He's had for 45 years and he's not running for re-election. 24 Democrats on the ballot. As you said, there are 22 active campaigns on that right now. But there's one candidate Van Hollen's been talking about.
Right. So
hold on, we have a bite. We have a bite. Hold on.
I want to alert voters in Maryland's 5th congressional district about the flood of outside special interest super PAC money that is coming into that district in support of one candidate, Adrian Boafo.
Now tell us about the senator's voice there and how that may or may not be impacting this very, very important race, but also a really difficult one to gauge because, again, there's so many people on the ballot.
It is a strong signal to progressive voters. That district, it is about, I looked at the numbers, it seems like the voting block is about 2-1 in terms of Democrats to Republicans, but particularly some of the carve out of that is within Prince George's County, which in Prince George's County, the ratio of registered Democrats to Republicans is 12-1, right? And so it is a very blue area, and the amount of votes that you need to win that race, because there's so many candidates on the ballot, is actually quite small compared to the region. And so because of that, every single move, every single, you know, word, endorsement does matter. And so you've had, Adrian has gotten the endorsements of Steny Hoyer, Governor Wes Moore, Senator Angela Alsobrooks, but seeing Van Hollen break out and actively go after Adrian as opposed to endorsing, but even not even endorsing, but going after him pretty much through that, through what he has said, was really fascinating. Adrian's response was also fascinating to me too. He mentioned that he agreed with Van Hollen that there shouldn't be this kind of money in politics, and that he wanted to get to Congress and work with Van Hollen to remove that money. But there is a lot of tension there, and there's a lot of calls of whether this, there's a lot of contradictory things that are happening at the same time.
And looking at nationally and internationally, some of the things Van Hollen's been speaking about, that includes Israel's push to get the U.S. involved in the on-again, off-again war with Iran.
Right.
And so this is said he's been waiting 40 years to do this. Turns out he finally found a president who was both stupid and reckless enough to join him. The war has killed 14 American service members, wounded hundreds more, and killed thousands of civilians. It's driving up the price of gas, food, and much more. Trump obviously doesn't care.
Then we'll go to Igor first and then Jenny. National ambitions for him right now, what could they be given this, given some of the things he's doing right now ahead of not just the Maryland primary this month, but also what he's speaking about nationally and internationally?
Well, look, I mean, I think that when people talk about 2028 candidates, Van Hollen isn't the first one that comes to the list. But I think literally every Democrat, prominent Democrat, is going to run in this race. And, you know, why not? You get a platform to speak out on what issues you want to highlight, what issues you think are important. And certainly Van Hollen right now seems to have an appetite for speaking out. I believe he's going to want to, you know, maybe potentially look at this race as a way to challenge Democratic establishment thought on this Israel-Palestine issue, as you've seen him speaking out already.
And is this a new Van Hollen, or is this a version of him that has been there all along? He was in House leadership before he decided to run for Senate 10 years ago. Has he always been this way, or are we just noticing it now?
I think we are noticing it. He's been a quiet workhorse. He's one of the nicest people here on Capitol Hill. I think he's just really coming into his own right now. And, you know, as you get up there in age and seniority in the Senate, you kind of start looking around what else is out there.
Jenny, has this, have you, the voters you've talked to in the D.C. suburbs where this big race is being decided, what are they saying about this? Is it having any impact? We always hear about endorsements or people getting on the sides of candidates and all that, but how much impact have you seen to it? Has people said this to you, that this is impacting how they might vote?
When I put the story out and I put it online as well, I've seen a lot of people say that they are very thankful that Van Hollen is calling this out. Money in politics, especially in this region and especially in that race, is so significant. And people do want to know who they feel that their politician is being influenced by. That is a strong thing that a lot of Americans talk about, care about, you know, not just in politics, but in almost every institution, right? Like, people want to know who's funding who and why. And so it is significant that he's brought that up and he's highlighting that. That is something that voters care about. Is it the number one issue voters vote on? That's the other question. But it is something that, you know, people feel, are you going to be a politician for me in, you know, this area and Arundel County and Prince George's County? Do you do that? Or are you going to do what, you know, these special interest groups want you to do? Are you going to do what, you know, he is also a lobbyist for Oracle, Adrian. And so that's also something that some people have been worried about, you know, the fact that he actively works to lobby Capitol Hill at this moment. And so, you know, there is a lot of questions about where loyalties lie. And okay. People want to know that it's with the voters.
Jenny Obama is a reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. And Igor Bumbich covers the U.S. Senate for Notice News of the United States. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, we talk to Bria Overs with our news partners at the Baltimore Banner about the effect ICE is having on one neighborhood in Baltimore just a day after two parents were detained in a violent takedown in the parking lot of an elementary school. I'm Matt Bush, and this is WIPR's Friday News Roundup. Stay with us after this short break.
Good afternoon. You are listening to WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where support comes from listeners like you and from the Maryland State Board of Elections. Early voting in Maryland runs today through June 18th. Polls are open daily from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Early voting center information is available at vote.md.gov/vote2026.
Maryland Unfolded is a new history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WIPR. We explore the people, events, and ideas that continue to shape Maryland's story. On the latest episode, we discuss Maryland politics during the Revolutionary War and former poet laureate Lucille Clifton. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
As a WYPR listener, you know that trustworthy news and local voices matter to you. You can support both and have a lasting impact on your community when you include a legacy gift to WYPR in your estate plans. Visit WYPR.org/legacy for more details.
Robert Coles was a child psychiatrist who worked with black school children who were desegregating the South, children like Ruby Bridges. She remembers his life on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's happening this afternoon at 4 here on WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1.
And welcome back. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, Maryland, and our country. I'm Matt Bush, the news director at WIPR. Yesterday, ICE detained two people outside of Commodore John Rogers Elementary and Middle School in East Baltimore as a pre-K graduation ceremony was taking place. It's the first time that immigration enforcement actions were taken on school grounds in the city since President Trump retook office last year. Earlier this year, an ICE official told Maryland school superintendents that agents would not enter school buildings, nor would they stage on school grounds. So yesterday's incident has shaken a lot of people. Local and state leaders have condemned the incident, with Mayor Brandon Scott calling it disturbing. ICE officials today say the man who was detained, Jesus Acevedo Sanchez, tried to evade them with his vehicle and drove to the school, where he was eventually taken into custody by agents in the bus loop that leads to the school. Video showed his wife and two children were in the car at the time of the stop, with one of them yelling at agents that her father did not do anything. Other children were also walking to the school while the stop was going on. In a court filing this morning, our news partners at the Baltimore Banner reported lawyer for Acevedo Sanchez says he's a native of Mexico who's been in the U.S. since 2001 and has no criminal history. This comes as another neighborhood in Baltimore is feeling the pinch of ICE raids. Bria Overs writes about consumer issues for the Baltimore Banner, and she's been spending some time in Highland Town, a neighborhood with a distinctly Latino feel. Bria, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of us have been to Highland Town, but it sounds like you've gone there a couple times recently to do some really in-depth reporting. Just to tell us a little bit about the neighborhood first before we begin, what's it like for people who aren't aware or who are unaware of it?
Yeah, I think that Highland Town is among one of the coolest neighborhoods in Baltimore. That's my opinion. I think that it's known as a very vibrant place. There's like a lot of businesses. It's known for its Main Street, for its arts district there. It's right next to Patterson Park, not far or above Canton. So it's sandwiched in between some really great neighborhoods. And it's kind of been rocked in recent months, because of its proximity to East Baltimore, where there is a high concentration of not only Latino immigrants, but, immigrants in general. And so it's been a tough time for the neighborhood.
You went there in November and then you went again in the spring, correct?
Yeah, I went multiple times. I had gone and hung out there a little bit in the summer, as some people do, but I started to really want to take a closer look at the neighborhood. Last year in November, I was preparing to write a story that was, look at how cool Highland Town is, and hoping that would kick off more stories about more neighborhoods in our city, in our communities that we love and want to highlight and shout out. But as time was going on and I kept going back to fact check things and to just take a closer look, meet new people, meet new business owners, I started to see a shift. And in particular, I went to an art walk in April, and it was completely different than the one I had gone to in November, like very noticeably different.
Now, you're not an immigration reporter. Your colleagues have done some great work on yesterday's incident and in general on this. So ICE is not something you typically focus on. Again, you're talking about business and consumer things and all that, but there was no way that you couldn't feel the ICE presence in that neighborhood as you went to investigate why things had changed in that 6-month period, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in the middle of the reporting that I was doing, there was an incident with Ovenbird Bakery in Highland Town at their Highland Town location. And that kind of highlighted like, oh, this is really like a real thing. It's a real issue. I mean, it had been going on for a while in the neighborhood, and there had been like a lot of concerns, and my colleagues have written great stories, you know, capturing moments of time in the neighborhood and in the area. But that was kind of like this is like really impacting businesses. And of course, I talked to a lot of business owners as a business reporter, and they started to tell me like our businesses are not doing as well as they were, as well as we had anticipated, especially once we hit spring. I think, again, with the April art walk, that was an like 80-degree day after we had been dealing with weeks and months of really frigidly cold weather. And so I thought like, this is going to be great. There's going to be so many people to talk to. And there just wasn't that many. I mean, it was still a great showing. You know, people are still in the neighborhood, and I don't want to paint it as a neighborhood that's just all bad or by any means. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of great things. The community is rallying around each other, but it's definitely been very different.
How have people been opening up to you? Have they? I mean, it's obviously a very difficult thing to talk about for any number of reasons. In some places, people just may not want to call attention to it. But, I mean, how have people been opening up to you, and what have they been saying to you about what's happened?
Yeah, people have been very open about it. At first, it was certainly a sensitive topic. People were a little bit hesitant, I think, because they were waiting to see how things would change. Wintertime, as a lot of small business owners have told me over the years, is usually a tougher time. People spend more time indoors, especially post-holidays. People just don't come out as much. They don't spend as much. They're kind of trying to reset a little bit. But it seemed like once we had gotten past that and spring started up, people were a lot more open because they could see a better picture of what was going on and had a little bit more of a clear view of the future for their businesses and for their neighborhood.
I mean, very quickly, in about a minute, what impact on these businesses that you looked at? You mentioned Ovenburn in particular. I mean, what impact has happened to these businesses in that time? I mean, what are they like now here in June?
Yeah.
This is the question.
I think the biggest thing I heard was that foot traffic. I mean, if you had gone to Highland Town any time last year, even last summer, there's a lot of hustle and bustle going on. A lot of people walking around. They have a great library, and so that's like a natural attraction point. You have all these restaurants and all these businesses, and so foot traffic is huge. People can easily walk around or catch public transit out there. And the biggest complaint was that there was foot traffic. One business owner told me, you know, my products, he's a clothing store. And he was saying, I haven't actually increased prices at all, despite inflation, despite all of these other rising costs. I've kept my prices the same. I'm not even going to be ordering anything more because I have like no customers. And so it has slowed down significantly in that way. Not a lot of walk-ins. Storefronts are pretty empty in the evenings, which are usually when people make time to make stops.
Bree Hovers is with our news partners, the Baltimore Banner. She's talking about Highland Town. She's going to stick with us after this short break. You stay with us, too.
You are listening to WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where support comes from J-More, Baltimore Jewish Living, presenting Mark My Word, the podcast that goes beyond the headlines and looks into the issues that affect Jewish Baltimore, with host Mark Terrell, available where you stream your podcast and at jmoreliving.com.
Practical Parenting, the new podcast from GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches to find joy in the process and thrive through it all. The goal? To ensure parents have the resources, support, and confidence they need. Practical Parenting from GBMC. Available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The number one metro area for young professionals? Any guesses?
I always joked growing up that I wanted to live somewhere green and fluffy, and I describe Alabama as that.
Birmingham, Alabama, to be precise. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Why college graduates are flocking to that city down south. Next time on Marketplace.
And that will be tonight at 6, Monday through Friday, Marketplace in the Daily at 6 p.m. WIPR is a media partner with the Friends of Patterson Park Concert Series, welcoming the Dirty Grass Players and their blend of traditional and progressive bluegrass with heady jams. Sunday, June 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Patterson Park Observatory. More information at PattersonPark.com. This is 88.1.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, the news director of the award-winning WIPR News team. Joining me in studio right now is Bria Overs with our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. We're talking about how ICE threats are changing the economics of one neighborhood in the city. Yesterday, an ICE detention ahead of a preschool graduation reminded many here that ICE has not gone away in the city. That happened outside the Commodore John Rogers Elementary and Middle School in East Baltimore. A pre-K graduation ceremony was taking place there. State and local leaders putting out many statements about this, including Governor Wes Moore, who said that school are places where children should feel safe, where parents should be able to drop their kids off without fear, and where educators should be able to focus on teaching, not where federal agents carry out immigration enforcement actions in front of children. Now, going back to Highland Town, Bria, one thing your story brought up was very interesting and a topic I think a lot of people may not assume would be impacted by immigration enforcement, and that is gentrification. So how is that impacting gentrification in Highland Town, these ICE actions that are going on not just in Highland Town but across the city?
Yeah, I think it's a two-part issue, right? Which is, one, if the neighborhood starts to lose residents out of concern and fear for immigration enforcement, then that kind of opens the door, creates vacancies. And when vacancies happen, that allows developers to kind of come in. And that's on the housing side, but also on the business side. So representatives for the Southeast CDC there, which is the Community Development Corporation, told me that about 20 years ago, the business district there had a vacancy rate of around 30%, which is pretty high. Mm-hmm. Today, and as far as 2025 goes, it's around 9.6%. So a huge reduction. They've worked really hard to turn things around and to maintain that, and they're hoping to reduce it even further. But if business owners start closing and start leaving, again, more of those vacancies, which could then open the door to developers to come in and buy up properties and change the fabric of the neighborhood. I would also add that the shops at Canton Crossing being so close by is kind of like a, could this start to migrate that way? So it I think it's a really surprising reaction that could happen to a neighborhood as a result of the enforcement.
And as you said in our last segment there and earlier and in your reporting as well, a lot of foot traffic changes in Highlandtown because of these actions as well. So something Rhea will be keeping an eye on. She's a reporter for our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, and a two-time guest now on the WIPR News Roundup. Thank you so much for coming in. It's always great to have you here.
Thank you.
After a quick break, it's not just graduates making their way out into the world this time of year. After a decade and a half as principal of Baltimore City College, Cindy Harkham is looking forward to a summer where she doesn't have to prepare to go back to school. She talks to one of her former students about what retirement from City College means. Then Pride. It's back in Baltimore on Charles Street, right on our front door, and there's some disagreement about some of the changes in Pride this year. We'll hear about that. I'm Matt Bush, and that's coming up next on the WIPR News Roundup. After this short break, stay with us.
You are tuned in to WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where support comes from True Chesapeake. This Sunday, True Chesapeake and Greater Goods host Summer Eco Market at Whitehall Mill from 11 to 3, featuring vendors, oysters, kid-friendly crafts and music, plus environmental groups. Open to the public. More information at truechesapeake.com.
My name is Margie Whitman, and I donated because I love WIPR, and I know at this point in time they need donations more than ever, and I want WIPR to continue in the great way that it does now. I feel like YPR is my friend and companion each day. I have been listening to WIPR for years and years, and I will continue to do so for the rest of my life. I give to YPR because I feel kind of expected to give to YPR. If I want to listen to this wonderful news that's real, and if I want to listen to all these wonderful shows that we get to do, then I feel I need to give to WIPR.
Support independent journalism today. Give online at WIPR.org.
Support for WIPR also comes from CFG Bank, headquartered in Baltimore. CFG Bank is transforming the banking experience for its clients and the community. More at cfg.bank, member FDIC.
And welcome back to the News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. The Baltimore City High School graduation season has come to a close. This week, graduates of Baltimore City College crossed the stage and celebrated a major milestone surrounded by family, friends, and the school community. The ceremony also served as an opportunity to honor Principal Cindy Harkham, who is preparing to retire after leading the Castle on the Hill since 2010. Past the mic, guest host Bree Reed, a graduate of City College, pays tribute to Harkham in her upcoming episode of Past the Mic.
Pass the Mic is made possible by a grant from the T. Rowe Price Foundation, recognizing 45 years of advancing thriving communities and building financial well-being. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not reflect the views of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, T. Rowe Price, or any of their subsidiaries or affiliates.
Pass the mic.
Hand that to me.
Pass it over here.
Pass the mic.
Pass the Mic gives you the space to share your stories, issues, and concerns your way. Today, we pass the mic to writer Bree Reed. She's a proud alum of Baltimore City College, and here she interviews outgoing principal Cindy Harkham about her memories and legacy at City.
Pass the mic.
Welcome to Pass the Mic. It's the show where every episode features a different host, someone from the community who leads a conversation on issues that matter to them. I'm Bree Reed, and I'll be your host for today's episode. I am a Baltimore-born and bred writer and researcher and frequent contributor to the Baltimore Beat, a Writers in Baltimore Schools board member, and a 2025 and 2026 Baker Artist Award finalist in literary art. When you ask somebody where they went to school in Baltimore, they won't tell you a college. They'll tell you a high school, and it matters. As a native Baltimorean, I have had the opportunity to attend one of the greatest schools in Baltimore, and if you ask me, one of the greatest public high schools in the world, Baltimore City College. Known affectionately as City to everyone who knows anything, to graduates as the Castle on the Hill, Baltimore City College ranks number 2 in Baltimore City Public High Schools in the U.S. News Best High Schools ranking for 2025-2026. The notable alumni include former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke, Lawrence Birney, and dozens of other changemakers in arts, culture, politics. So to help me talk about public education, about why public high schools matter so deeply in Baltimore City, I get to talk to my former principal when I was a student, and the newly retired principal of Baltimore City College, Principal Cindy Harkum. So to tell you a bit about Principal Harkum, she has served as principal at Baltimore City College since 2010. Principal Harkum walked the halls as a student, a graduate in the class of 1988, and then returned as an educator in the English department. She started in the role as an interim principal while they tried to find someone to fit the role, it became clear that the woman in the role already was the clearest choice to continue to lead. Thanks for being here, Principal Harkum.
Thank you for having me.
I can't thank you enough for being here. When Mallory and the WYPR team contacted me and said, we'd love to have you on Pass the Mic. You get an episode to talk about just about anything you want. I said immediately, I want to talk about City. How apropos that I get to talk to the woman who served as my principal when I walked the halls and has shared the experience of being a student. You've experienced City every level that I think you can, also as a parent of a graduate.
That's correct. That's correct. I've lived at the Castle for about 38 years, if you really do the math on it all. Someone figured out that a woman could actually lead from the inside, someone who's been with it for a while. And I had the wonderful opportunity of being a part of City College for 16 years as principal, 29 years as an employee of City, but 32 years with the actually Baltimore City Public Schools.
There's alum who return to school as staff, and that's a frequent tradition at City. And then there's you, Principal Harkum. For you, what makes City an institution you committed to for your career?
City is an awesome school. And I'm not saying that just because I went there. It's a special place. You don't see high schools like City College around the U.S., but it's a special place in which the students care for one another. The faculty cares for the students. It's a college-ready atmosphere. It's full of legacy and commitment and dedication to the community around. And the graduates, get involved. They're not just smart. They're caring leaders. City College exists on the National Registry of Historic Places because of the people that you had mentioned who graduated from City, people like Elijah Cummings and Kurt Schmoke, people who have come through the halls of the Castle and then returned to give back to the Castle. So staying with City was just an important part of the development of City's graduates.
Absolutely.
City forever.
City forever. I was going to get into, we have so many deep traditions, and one that sticks with me is our school motto. Honor to one who earns it.
That's right. Palmam qui merit ferat. You learn it. You get indoctrinated with it, and by the at the start of your freshman year, and we remind you of it all the way through until you graduate.
Yeah.
And then it just sticks with you to understand that hard work pays off.
There are City teachers, City educators, City College counselors that I still think about and stay in contact with today, who have shaped the rest of my life. In my time at City, I lost 3 grandparents. And I talk about that a lot when I share the story of my coming of age, because for some people, grandparents are people who maybe mail you money on your birthday, might call once a month. My grandparents were truly my mother's co-parents. And so to lose them at such a critical time, I don't think I could have survived the waves of grief that were hitting me if I did not go to a place that so closely held their students like City. There was not a moment where even when I wanted to dissociate and falter, I literally remember college advising council and those counselors tracking me down and being like, this school wants to hear from you. We have to send them this. It's like, even when I was falling through the cracks of just like grief and sadness, there was like, we can hold you. we can hold you up and we can continue on this road together. And you're so right in all of that. In 2010, Ron Casey detailed your early days as interim principal for Baltimore Magazine. I don't know if you remember.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it raises the question, can city be great again?
Mm-hmm.
After 16 years, what do you say to that question?
City is awesome. City is better than ever. We have culture of student body who is not only making, you know, great grades in college, doing well, earning the credits. We have a graduation rate that has been consistently high in the last 4 years, above a 98% average. They're finding their majors faster. They're getting involved in clubs and other activities. They're taking leadership roles on campus. They're still reaching back to the school, whether it's tutoring, connecting with their staff members. They tell us this college is easy, you know, excited about what they're doing in their majors, which includes STEM, a lot of STEM. So it's great that our kids are well-rounded. My daughter is a City College graduate who just graduated from the University of College Park, majoring in architecture, and she's going on to grad school for architecture, and she DJs. And that's the City College student.
It is.
You know, it's a profile that says this individual can take risks. They're knowledgeable, but they're also principled and they're willing to challenge themselves.
Yeah.
And I think seeing that evolution of the collegian beyond where we started 2010 is really important.
I'm sure you've been asked this question already, but for our listeners, what's next for you? If you can give us a little teaser of what you'll be up to.
Well, I'm still working on that. I keep joking that I haven't had a summer for about 25 years, meaning like one that's not what my head is filled with plans for the school year, prepping for the school year. So I'm looking forward to some rest for sure and just some opportunity to spend a little bit more time with the family. I'm not going to say goodbye to education, but I'm also definitely stepping away from the leadership role of it. I still love teaching. I love working with students. Our city kids are amazing. Public education saves lives. Let's just be very serious about that. And, you know, giving kids the opportunity to show their value, to respect their abilities, means that we're giving them opportunities for the future to get employed, to earn money, to have the families and the type of opportunities that they deserve. And I'm especially talking about Black and brown children in Baltimore.
And I'll never forget being that senior year student. We're reading Baldwin. I'm learning about equilibrium, right? I'm writing full essays in Spanish about the history and culture of the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing all of this using my mother's lovely tax dollars in a public education. And then I go outside of city and I talk to students who go to private school and they're like, you're as smart as we are. And I'm like, I'd argue that the way
smarter,
the way that city encourages a rigor.
Those, you know, of us who love teaching, we stayed in it because we saw in the long term the importance it has on kids' lives.
Thank you, Principal Harcum. I can't wait to hear what's next for you. And I hope you get a summer, many summers
from here on out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pass the Mic is produced by Elizabeth Nonamaker, senior producer Mallory Pinker-Pierre, and executive producer Amy Walters. This is a presentation of Baltimore Public Media.
More episodes of Pass the Mic are available at WYPR.org. You can also listen and subscribe to Pass the Mic wherever you get podcasts. You can do the same for this show, too. Next up, Pride marches down Charles Street, then Druid Hill Park, but not everyone's excited about the change in venue. I'm Matt Bush, and that's coming up next on WYPR's News Roundup. Stay with us.
Maryland Unfolded is a new history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. We explore the people, events, and ideas that continue to shape Maryland's story. On the latest episode, we discuss Maryland politics during the Revolutionary War and former poet laureate Lucille Clifton. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And as we were driving away from our apartment and it was getting smaller and smaller, I was wondering, where will I be at the end of the summer? Would I be free? Would I be dead or back in East Germany?
Join us for stories of near misses, great escapes, and the people that hold your hand through it all. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Don't miss the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 in the afternoon here on WYPR. Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where support comes from listeners like you and from In Series, presenting the world premiere of The Song of Shakuntala, an opera by Timothy Nelson that blends Western and Indian classical music with India's celebrated dramatic masterpiece, June 19th through the 21st at Baltimore Theater Project. More information is available at theaterproject.org. This is 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of WIPR's news team. Baltimore Pride is this weekend, and Saturday's parade route will head up Charles Street right in front of our studios. But as the parade winds to a close, revelers will have to pack up and head to Druid Hill Park as part of the festival's new location. Amari Gray Johnson wrote about the festival's history and its possible futures for the Baltimore Beat. Amari Gray, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Just to start us off, for people who haven't been to Pride in Baltimore before, describe what the experience is like. Set the scene for us.
For sure. Baltimore Pride is one of the oldest prides in the country, going back to, I want to say, 1975. I started going as a teenager when, at the time, their events would be from Friday to Sunday, with the main event, of course, being the tradition of the Pride Parade and the Block Party or festival. And really, people of all ages, I would see with their families, families of all kinds, along with community groups, organizations, leaders, marching in Charles Street. At the time, we were in Mount Vernon. And now it's grown into a week-long series of events with your traditional annual parade and block party, as well as spaces for youth, for resource sharing, sober spaces, spaces for partying, all of this now being a week-long series of events.
Pride is obviously just more than the parade, it's history. Tell us about what the history of Pride in Baltimore is.
Yeah, well, the history of Pride in general, or the Pride March, goes back to the gay liberation marches of the 70s, traces through the spark that the Stonewall Rebellion had on the gay liberation movement, and also really has roots in the protest traditions of the civil rights movement that inspired that. And so all of that, I think, is to say that the foundation of Pride, like, in my opinion, the foundation of Baltimore, is Black folks, transgender folks, women. And for me, that's also what makes our city's Pride every year very unique. Because those are the people that are still making things happen and creating even newer spaces for Pride, like Trans Pride from Maryland Safe Haven, or Charm City Pride from our queer party collectives.
Now, Baltimore Pride has been historically been a community-run event. You've looked at this in some of your reporting. So tell us a bit about how it's always been put together and how it might be changing now in the future.
Yeah, so the Baltimore Pride Parade and Festival has, since its inception, been organized by what is now called the Pride Center of Maryland. And the organization has kind of taken different names and forms over the decades, but it's traditionally been run by leaders and community members from the Pride Center, with feedback and input from vendors, sponsors, past participants, and the recap interviews that they get every year.
Now, the Pride Festival has been moved twice in the past year, first from Station Arts North District, Station North Arts District, let me get that right, to the Wyman Park Dell. Now it's going to be moved to Druid Hill Park. Tell us what went into these decision-making that did this, and what effect is that going to have on the event?
Yeah, so last year, what went into the decision-making from the city's end was this idea that the Pride Parade was growing in size and was outgrowing having the festival on Charles Street. And so there are differing estimates around numbers for attendance at the Pride festivals in the past few years. Some that the Pride Center had offered up to the city around 100,000 people, and that community members aren't necessarily agreeing with in terms of those estimates. And so the reasons that the city provides for wanting to move the festival kind of in, I think, the ears of community members falls flat when there's now isn't this shared foundation of what the actual reality of the experience is. But last year, that's what precipitated the movement of the festival to Wyman Park Dell, where community members felt like their visibility was significantly impacted, because Wyman Park Dell is an enclosed space. It's kind of tree lined on all sides. It's a steep hill. You have to walk down steps. And so they had accessibility issues, carrying tents and materials for their booths from the parade to the Dell, having a lack of parking access and having to park several blocks away and lug materials there into the park, and then still not being able to have their booths properly seen or being able to properly navigate the festival as they would have in the years that it had been in the street. And now this year, the city is again moving from Wyman Park Dell to Druid Hill Park, citing concerns over the safety of Wyman Park Dell, which is kind of a recurring theme. And now Druid Hill Park poses the challenges of being very much separate from the parade route and having participants, as well as those who will be having booths at the festival, have to navigate transportation of themselves and of the materials from the end of the parade all the way to Druid Hill Park.
And it's just not the geography of what you just explained there. It's also dragging sort of the Pride Festival, certainly the festival at the end, further and further away from Mount Vernon and Station North, is sort of the traditionally neighborhoods that are historically significant to the gay community in Baltimore. I mean, what do people think of that?
Absolutely. I think it's a significant loss for queer businesses and queer safe spaces that are in Mount Vernon and Station North, what we would call the neighborhood. And so the Baltimore Eagle, the Drinkery, spaces that would normally see so much business over the years during Pride, may experience something very different this weekend. And I think community members who would patronize those spaces also feel that loss as well. And folks who are participating in the festival again and who have for years are now wondering, even more so than last year, what will the attendance be like at their booths? Will they be able to get the support that they need, whether it is that they are fundraising and will have fundraising at their booths, or passing out information, or just want to bring awareness, or just trying to attract new members of their organizations or into whatever it is that they're doing. And now, or after the impacts on their ability to have people come to their booths last year at the festival, now at Druid Hill Park, they're very much uncertain whether people will even make the effort to come from the parade to the festival, or whether they'll even properly know what is happening this year, where the festival will be, with all of kind of the last minuteness of the communication of these changes.
Well, again, the memorandum of understanding between the city and the Pride Center of Maryland gives the city the authority to select the date, location, and logistical planning considerations related to the Baltimore Pride Festival and Block Party. So given that, what might the future of Baltimore Pride look like? It's moved, obviously, the last 3 years. Might it move again, depending on how things go this weekend?
Well, that is the question on everyone's mind. It very well could move again. And as we see, the location of the festival has a large impact on the location of the parade. And so the festival moves. Will the Pride Center to make the decision to change the parade route? Will the city seek to have authority over the parade in the future as well? And if that's where it starts, where does it end for how the city seeks to control the public presence of Baltimore's queer community? I think that's really the deeper question that's on everyone's mind, especially when the moment that we're in, where queer folks, trans folks especially, are afraid to be in public, are being taken out of public spaces. And now what has been traditionally a community-run autonomous event is being controlled by a government that we are not seeing clear communication and transparency from.
Amari Gray Johnson writes for the Baltimore Beat. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, and happy Pride.
Thank you. Happy Pride.
The Baltimore Pride Parade is tomorrow, June 13th, starting at noon on North Avenue and Charles Street, marching north past our studios, with the party taking place afterwards at Druid Hill Park. And that's it for the WIPR News Roundup. Next week, it's Juneteenth. Tell us how you're celebrating the holiday in Maryland. You can leave us a voice memo at 410-735-1616. I'm Matt Bush, News Director at WIPR. Isaac Moss, Elizabeth Nonemaker, and Mallory Pinker DePierre helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers. Emmy Walters is our Executive Director. Thanks for listening.
Think about what you hear when you tune to WIPR. We cover the arts, local government, the environment, health, education, sports, culture, history, books, food, and wine. And that's just our own locally produced programs. I'm Lisa Morgan. Join me and others just like you who value WIPR and all the news and information we bring you every day, from around the world with NPR and the BBC, and around Maryland with our local team of dedicated reporters, hosts, and producers. Your support makes it all possible.
We simply couldn't do it without you. Become a member now at WYPR.org, and thanks.